have AJ. She's a 22-year-old female with, admitted to the ICU with a blood glucose of 476 and a pH of 7.1. What further questions or testing would we do to determine if she has type 1 or type 2 diabetes? So we have this patient, she comes in, her blood sugar's high, and we want to know, why do we give us this pH number? Well, the truth is, when you start burning fat for fuel, it lowers your pH. Now, who would burn fat for fuel? Well, type 1s do. So let's talk about this a little bit more, because type 1s don't make enough insulin to use glucose for fuel. They have to burn fat for fuel. And so let's go over this a little bit in more detail through these next slides. So type 1 diabetes is also increasing globally, and we're trying to figure out how to give treatment for people with type 1 diabetes. In the early days in the 1920s, this photo is actually from 1921, there was many children in the United States and globally suffering with type 1 diabetes, but there was no treatment for them at that point. So you can see, here's a mother holding her little boy. It's such a difficult picture to look at, because you can see this child is essentially starving. His pancreas is completely broken. He makes no insulin whatsoever. And so he eats food, it turns into sugar, the sugar goes into his bloodstream, but the cells can't use it for fuel because there's no insulin to open up the cells and allow the glucose in. So that little child can't use carbohydrates for fuel, it turns into glucose, he's just urinating it out. So he's had to go to alternate energy sources. And the next thing he's used is all of his fat. So when people are, you know, malnourished, they start using fat for energy. And with type 1 diabetes, if you can't use glucose because your pancreas isn't making any insulin, these little kids use fat for fuel. And so you can see, he has no fat on his bones whatsoever or anywhere in his body. And when you use fat for fuel, your liver has to break that fat down, and it does cause the development of ketones. And ketone bodies are acids, and they make your pH go down. And that's the term diabetes ketoacidosis. So that's going to make the acids in your blood increase and cause your pH to go down. And that can be, you know, life-threatening. So this little boy has used fat for fuel, and he's also used his muscles for energy. So he's trying to get the amino acids out of his muscle to get fuel to his body. And so this is such a tragic picture, but I do have good news for you, that right around that year, in 1922, Banting and Betts did discover insulin, and they were able to give this little boy insulin, and he lived. This little boy lived. That's not him. This is not him. Hopefully you can see my screen as of right now. This is Gary Hall. We'll actually see this boy again in my insulin webcast series, where you will see how insulin transformed him. And insulin is a life-saving hormone, and there's, you know, millions of people in America right now living with diabetes and doing really great, living with type 1 diabetes and, you know, just succeeding like crazy. This is Gary Hall, an Olympic athlete. He went to Greece. He went to Australia after being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and his blood sugars did require a lot of management and adjustment, but he was able to win gold medals both in Greece and Australia. So it doesn't stop anyone from doing anything. Here's some facts about diabetes. About 3 million Americans have type 1, and each year approximately 80 people per day are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and most of them are now adults. So it's 15% are children, but these children, of course, grow up to adulthood, so 85% of people with type 1 diabetes are adults living with it and managing it. The rate is going up 3% annually. And we don't really know why, but we do know that all autoimmune diseases throughout America are increasing, and they're increasing not only in America but globally, especially the Scandinavian countries, Finland, and those other countries are having a dramatic increase in type 1 diabetes. And so we're trying to figure out why. Why are our levels of type 1 increasing globally, and why are more people getting autoimmune diseases? Because type 1 diabetes is autoimmune. It's the pancreas destroying itself. But we're thinking maybe it's the changes in the environmental exposure. So diabetes is always a combination of your genes. So you have the gene for type 1. We know that people who have parents with type 1 diabetes are much more likely to get it. Or if you have a sibling with type 1 diabetes, you have the genetics for type 1. So you have the genes plus the environment. What in the environment is going to increase your risk of type 1? And we're thinking that one thing might be exposure to viruses. So we definitely know, like, Coxsackie virus and other viruses can trigger the expression of type 1 diabetes, but we're also thinking about the bacteria in our gut and in the environment. As it turns out, we're getting a lot less exposure to bacteria in our environment. We're much more hygienic and clean, but maybe we need those bacteria. As you know, the bacteria on our body outnumber our own cells 10 to 1. So we've had this synergistic relationship with bacteria since the beginning of man. And by getting rid of these bacteria, we might be getting rid of helpers, of friends, of allies that are helping us fight off invaders, stopping autoimmunity, helping us digest nutrients. And so we're really taking a look at this thing called the hygiene hypothesis. Are we just getting our environment too clean and not interacting with the bacteria enough to help keep us in balance? Look at this. I have a very interesting thing, obesity. There's just a term called obesogenicity. Obesogenicity, or our environment, is obesogenic. So is our environment promoting us being overweight? That's what we're looking at. And actually, kids who are overweight might have a greater risk of getting type 1 diabetes because their pancreas is so stressed out. That's another theory. So this looks at the incidence of type 1 in youth. The general population, only 0.3%, but you can see, as I've mentioned, if you have a brother, sister, mother, father, you're much higher risk of expressing type 1 diabetes. And there's a lot of studies underway looking at the natural history of type 1, but also can we provide some intervention to stop it? And if you think about type 1 diabetes, if you look at all people with diabetes, only 10% have type 1, 90 to 95% have type 2. So it's a combination of your genetics and your risk factors, as I've mentioned. It's an autoimmune destruction of your beta cells. The most common age of expression is the ages of 10 through 14, right during puberty, because during puberty we get very insulin resistant and we're much more likely to express diabetes type 1 during that time if we have the genetic risk and the environment is supporting that expression. People with type 1 diabetes are very insulin sensitive because they don't reject insulin. They just, like, they're not insulin resistant. They are just lacking insulin. So they need very low doses of insulin to replace what their pancreas isn't making. So autoimmunity tends to run in family. So type 1, as I've mentioned, is a combination of genes of an environment. So if my family member has type 1 diabetes, I'm much more likely to get it. But also, if my family member has thyroid disease, celiac disease, rheumatoid arthritis, other autoimmune diseases, that also increases my risk of expressing autoimmune type 1. So we're always looking within families for clustering of autoimmunity to let us know that person's at more risk. There are higher rates in non-breastfed infants, so we know breastfeeding protects against type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And as I mentioned, there are viral triggers. So if I have the genetics for type 1, if I get exposed to rubella, Coxsackie virus, cytomegalovirus, mumps, that might trigger the type 1 expression. As a matter of fact, they're actually looking at a vaccine against Coxsackie virus for people with type 1. Isn't that interesting? So if I had the genetics for type 1, giving me a Coxsackie vaccine might actually prevent that cascade of autoimmunity from triggering on. They're working on it, and that's through TrialNet, which I'll talk about in a minute. But I do want to point out that people with type 1 are living longer. Average age expectancy is 68.5. That was a few years ago. So we've really made some great improvements on managing type 1 and helping people with type 1 live long, healthy lives. So let's get back to our AJ. How do we know if she has type 1 or type 2 diabetes? Well, let's just think about it. usually with type 1 diabetes, they come in and they're leaner. They look sick. They're dehydrated. They're drinking lots of water. They're going to the bathroom a lot. People with type 1 diabetes usually end up in the emergency room early on because they feel so bad and they'll seek medical help. So usually we find type 1 pretty early on. The one caveat is very young children. Sometimes their diagnosis is missed. So we really want to get the word out to parents about signs of diabetes and what to do, and that they just need a simple blood sugar test to evaluate it. But sometimes we may not be sure if they're type 1 or type 2, because I've mentioned that with type 1, they present and they're usually thinner. But if 70% of our people are overweight and 30% of kids are overweight, even with new type 1, they might have lost some weight, but they might still present overweight when we see them. And so if we're not sure, we'll draw these autoantibodies, and there's three of them: GAD, ICA, and IAA, and I've spelled them out for you here. These are autoantibodies associated with type 1 diabetes. So if we're not sure, we can actually draw their blood and look to see if any of these come back positive, the GAD, ICA, or IAA. If these come back positive, that tells us this person is more of a type 1, insulin required. That's really important to keep in mind. So we don't do this for all patients, but if we're not sure, we will look at these autoantibodies and evaluate. But if we think they're type 1, we start them on insulin. So that's the main important thing. Regardless, if they look lean and we try oral medications and they don't work, they need insulin. And so we can usually tell if they're type 1 by their presentation, and we try treatment. And if the oral medications don't work, we definitely know that they're type 1. They need some insulin. And that's another way you can determine it if you don't have access to drawing these autoantibodies. All right. So here's the other conditions associated with type 1 disease. These are other autoimmune conditions I've mentioned: celiac and thyroid disease, the two prominent ones in my mind. If patients come in with these, I'm thinking that they probably are more likely to express, type 1. They're at risk for type 1 diabetes because it is also an autoimmune disease. What does type 1 look like? I love this slide. Look at all these amazing people living and doing great with type 1 diabetes. Mary Tyler Moore in her 80s, active her entire life. Here's another Laker guy. He plays on the Lakers. Type 1 diabetes. Brett Michaels, Nick Jonas, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. I mean, amazing. Type 1 doesn't stop anyone from doing anything. So now we've determined that AJ has type 1. Is there any other tests or screenings that we should do for her with this new diagnosis of type 1 diabetes? And I do want to say that upon diagnosis of diabetes, this is from the American Diabetes Association clinical practice recommendations, and we'll put a link for that in your resource page. But we need to check their A1C, look at their lipids, do a kidney function test, which is microalbuminuria and GFR. We need to look at their thyroid, see how well that's working, because they could simultaneously express type 1 diabetes and thyroid disease. We definitely want to screen for celiac disease, and we'll talk about that more in our nutrition lecture. Celiac disease is much more common in type 1 diabetes, so we need to evaluate for that. We need to look at their liver function. Look at all of this. Annual dilated eye exam. We need to talk about family planning. Any woman of childbearing age with diabetes, we need to discuss family planning to help prevent pregnancy till they're really ready. We need to look at a registered dietitian for medical nutrition therapy. Get them into diabetes education. I was just reading a study that only 10% of people with newly diagnosed diabetes make it into a diabetes education program or see a dietitian. And we know these programs work great. They can lower A1Cs by 1 to 2 percentage points. So getting people into diabetes education programs is a critical part of their care. Looking at their teeth, and then mental health care professional if needed. Let's take a look at this patient. He is 43 years old. He's admitted to the hospital to evaluate angina. His morning blood sugar is 92. But based on the scale in this hospital, no insulin is required. The scale starts at 150. He gets, you know, 2 units for every 50 over 150. On the breakfast tray shows up and the patient says, hey, I need my insulin shot before I eat. What do we say? This is such a great question because this patient with type 1 diabetes absolutely needs insulin before he eats. So we're going to ask him, what would you normally do at home? And that is the right answer in these situations. Any patient in the hospital with diabetes who's been living with it, they know their diabetes best. They are an expert in their own diabetes. So if they say, I need insulin, I'm like, how much? And then I get on the horn to the doc and I say, can we implement this patient's usual insulin regimen in the hospital setting? And I've never had a provider say no to me because they know that getting blood sugars to target in the hospital is very important. And we'll be talking about this also more in our lecture on insulin therapy. So type 1 summary, it's a complete destruction of the pancreas. The patients need insulin replacement therapy, often first present in DKA, and they are at risk for other autoimmune diseases. Okay, let's take a look at this other situation. We have a patient, she's 58 years old. She says, I've had type 1 diabetes for 18 years, but she quit smoking a year ago and gained 20 pounds. Her BMI is now 25. So remember we said a BMI of 25 or greater is considered overweight. And so she's gained some weight, so she's on the verge of overweight here. Here's her medications. She's on Humalog. Now, Humalog is a fast-acting insulin. She's on it before each meal. But this is really kind of perplexing to me because usually with type 1 diabetes, as I've mentioned, your insulin dose is pretty low. It's like, you know, 5 units every meal. That would, you know, 3 to 5 units, something like that. She's on 18, so I'm already wondering what's happening here. She's on Lantus, 28 units at bedtime. Again, a high dose of basal insulin for somebody with type 1, so I'm kind of just head scratching right now. And then she tells me she's on metformin. Now, metformin is a medication usually used for type 2 diabetes. It tells the liver to stop making so much glucose. So now I'm really perplexed. This patient has type 1 and she's on insulin plus metformin. And so we're trying to figure out, is she really type 1? Is this the right diagnosis? And I did ask her if she ever got her labs checked for GAD, ICA, IAA. She didn't remember. And so as I was thinking about it and reading more about this, I believe that this patient has what I would call double diabetes. She has type 1 diabetes, but she also had a family history of type 2. Her mom had type 2 diabetes. Plus, she had gained weight, especially around her middle. And when you gain weight around your middle and you increase your visceral adiposity, you become more insulin resistant. So look at this. 25% of patients with type 1 also have type 2 diabetes. And I was in a post-grad meeting at the American Diabetes Association where they talked about this. And lately, I just wrote a whole newsletter called Double Diabetes, where we're seeing a lot of our patients with type 1 who are gaining weight are becoming more insulin resistant and are requiring other therapies to help get their blood sugars down. There's a big study right now called the Removal Study where they're actually looking at patients with type 1 adding metformin therapy. They're studying this. So the jury's not out. We're not sure yet how to treat this, but I certainly think if you have a patient with type 1 and they're on insulin, adding metformin would help reduce insulin resistance and might improve their overall glucose control. That's still in the research. We're still studying it, but I just want to share that with you because in my practice, a lot of my type 1s are heavy and they're struggling because we keep increasing their insulin and they keep gaining more weight. Is there another strategy to help get their blood sugars down without that weight gain? So I'm going to put a link for their double diabetes newsletter in your resources too so you can take a look at that. Okay, so we have type 1 diabetes, so we have type 1 plus type 2, and the next kind of diabetes I want to talk about is LADA. Now, I was going to share a poll with you, but I'm not going to share it because it seems to kind of mess things up. But LADA stands for Latent Autoimmunity Diabetes in Adult. And this is from Diabetes Forecast. I took this picture. They go type 1, type 2, look at this intersection. Is LADA a blending of type 1 plus type 2? Let's just take a look at what I'm talking about. So we have a patient here. She's 72 years old. Her A1C 3 months prior was 6.2. 3 months later, it jumped up all the way to 13.9. Her BMI is 24.5, and she lost about 10 pounds over the last month, but she told you, well, I was trying to lose some weight. So this is very peculiar. Type 2s don't jump from 6.2 to 13.9 in 3 months. Type 2, as I mentioned, is a gradual process. So what happened here that this blood sugar jumped up so much? So we actually we called the provider and we said, you know what, doc, could you check her autoimmunity? Could you check GAD, ICA, IAA? And we did, because we thought maybe she's more of a type 1. And when the labs came back, sure enough, she had a positive GAD. So that tells us she has more of an autoimmune type of diabetes. And so what does that do for us? Well, it tells us we need to start insulin therapy, because insulin therapy may preserve beta cell function. And so the utility of knowing this, LADA, is a lot of our patients who, you know, are called type 2, but they walk into our office and they're kind of lean. You're like, they don't really look like a type 2. They're a little bit older. Maybe they're more of a type 1, and we need to start insulin therapy early. So some clinical features of LADA is that they're usually a little bit younger, under the age of 50, compared to our type 2s. They usually have more acute hyperglycemia, like in this situation that A1C just jumped up, BMI less than 25, so they're on the leaner side. History of autoimmune disease and family history of autoimmune disease, very strong. So, and patients in this situation, we just want to be aware of them, because they're going to need insulin therapy early on to protect their beta cells that they have left and prevent glucose toxicity. LADA. And if you are ever planning to take the CDE exam, they do talk about LADA now in the exam. It's a recognized condition that we need to be familiar with as providers of diabetes education and care. Okay, let's just take a look at Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones is 62 years old. She's overweight and complaining of feeling tired and urinating several times a night. She comes into the hospital with a UTI. White count is up. Blood sugar is 237. She's hypertensive with a history of gestational diabetes, no ketones in her urine. So we've talked about type 1 diabetes, we've talked about type 1 plus type 2, and we've talked about LADA. So now we're going to talk about type 2 diabetes. So what are this particular patient's risk factors for type 2? Let's just go over them. Well, she's 62 years old. 20% of people over the age of 60 have type 2 diabetes. She's overweight. What other risk factor does she have? Keep going. Hypertension is a risk factor, and gestational diabetes. So those are all her risk factors for getting type 2. So she's got plenty of them. What are her signs of diabetes? Well, tired, urinating several times a night, and her blood sugar, 237. So we said a random blood sugar of 200 or more equals diabetes. So we're assuming she's has type 2 diabetes. And does she have insulin resistance? Yeah, she does. Anybody who's overweight with high blood sugars has insulin resistance, because that overweight, especially in the belly area, we call it visceral adiposity, increases resistance to insulin and raises blood sugars. And so she's got a lot of risk factors for diabetes, and here she presents with a urinary tract infection, which is really common. A lot of people with type 2 diabetes present in the hospital first with a cellulitis, a urinary tract infection. They might have a pneumonia. They get infections more because their blood sugars are high, which feeds the bacteria, plus their white blood cells don't work as good to fight off bacteria. So infections are one of the signs of type 2 diabetes. Let's take a look at this gal. You might know her, Patti LaBelle. Patti LaBelle, very famous singer, you know, full of life and energy. But like a lot of us, she was busy with life. She was singing and performing and touring, and she wasn't taking that good care of her health. And she actually passed out on stage, and they found out she had type 2 diabetes. Well, Patti LaBelle did not let that stop her. And here's what Patti LaBelle says. I'm a diabetic. She's a diabetic. Is that great? That's a mix of diabetic and diva. And actually, Patti LaBelle ended up losing weight, getting a trainer, writing a cookbook on diabetes. So she saw this as an opportunity to really take care of her health. So good for her. And a lot of our patients will do that. They'll recognize that they need to make some changes. So as we gain more body weight over time, here's a visual image of BMI. So we were saying that a BMI of less than 25 is considered normal, but once we get to 25 to 30, we're moving to obesity and BMI of 40. Well, this is overweight. BMI of 25 or greater is overweight. BMI of 30 or greater is moving into obesity. And you can see a lot of the extra weight is carried here, abdominally or viscerally. And that visceral fat really increases the risk of expressing not only diabetes, but hypertension and hyperlipidemia. So we definitely want to check, find people at risk for diabetes. Who's at risk? Anybody overweight, BMI of 25 or greater. Already you're at risk for getting type 2 diabetes. But there's additional risk factors we want to be on the lookout for, and I've listed them for you here. First degree relative, member of a high-risk ethnic population that we've mentioned, not exercising, prediabetes, history of heart disease, hypertension, low HDL, having a big baby, and if you're having any signs of insulin resistance, and one of the signs of insulin resistance is this thing called acanthosis nigricans. So acanthosis nigricans is darkening of the skin and the areas where you bend or rub together, like your elbows, your knees, your ankles, under your breast, your underarms, and also near your groin. All of these areas can exhibit this darkening of the skin. This is a thickening and darkening of the skin, which is a manifestation of insulin resistance in your skin. The skin becomes thick and dark, and you might even get these skin tags. If you see this in patients or people that you know and love, like when you have your holiday gatherings, look at everybody's necks and elbows to see if they have this, because it's a sign of insulin resistance, and it's often associated with abdominal obesity. And it tells us this patient or this person is at risk for diabetes in the future. So we want to keep a very close eye on not only their blood sugar, but their blood pressure and their cholesterol. So that's just the body's way of telling us that this person has insulin resistance. So type 2 diabetes is now, we're, you know, talking about type 2 is a complex metabolic disorder. There's not enough insulin being made, and the insulin that is made, the body pushes it away. So there's pathology in the body, but look at this definition. With social, behavioral, and environmental risk factors unmasking genetic susceptibility. So it's your genes plus your environment. So I just want to say that there's a zip code study that looked at people who live in, you know, Stockton, for example, that they have a shorter life expectancy because of the revenue, and their socioeconomic status is a little bit lower than people living in Beverly Hills, for example. So that's an example of environment. We know where we grow up and where we live affects our life expectancy. And that seems like a really important health disparity to take a look at. I'll just kind of plant that seed. So we're trying to think of improving the health of all of our people. I do want to say also that if you have any patient who's newly diagnosed with diabetes, you can call 1-800-DIABETES to request a getting started kit, and they will send this to your patients right away. And it has lots of information for people. It's in English and it's in Spanish, to help them get started with diabetes and make some good choices around food and activity and so forth. So really, really worth sharing with our patients. We talked about the natural history of diabetes, but let me just show it to you in a different way. So this is 20 years before diagnosis of diabetes. You can see right here, there's some insulin resistance. So this is from our genetics, if our mom had gestational diabetes, or if diabetes runs in our family, we're born with this genetic risk of insulin resistance. Now we gain weight, we don't exercise as much. It's going to make the situation worse. And look what happens. The insulin resistance increases, and insulin secretion starts rising initially. So your pancreas is going to respond to insulin resistance by cranking out more and more insulin. And it's going to try to maintain your blood sugars for as long as it possibly can. And it does so for, I don't know, about 10, 15 years. But look here. Right now, we start seeing those blood sugars going up. Here's a fasting blood sugar on the rise. Here's postprandial glucose on the rise. This is pre-diabetes. And so now, on this side, we've moved into diabetes, where insulin secretion has steadily diminished over time. Insulin resistance remains constant. And so this is what happens with diabetes type 2, that the pancreas just makes less and less insulin. And if you have this type 2 long enough, you make very little insulin. And it is true, about 30% of people with diabetes need insulin therapy because their pancreas isn't making enough insulin. So this is the natural history of diabetes. You have the insulin resistance, it increases, and then it maintains a steady state. But the insulin secretion tries to match that resistance, but over time the pancreas just poops out, and then the blood sugars start to rise. When we think about type 2 diabetes, then, we know that there's many things broken when we look at type 2 diabetes. And let's just go over what's broken with type 2 diabetes. Well, number one, the pancreas is broken. There's 80% loss of the production of insulin at diagnosis of diabetes. So type 2 diabetes means you only have 20% of those beta cells making insulin. What's also broken is your liver. Your liver is just pumping out extra sugar, especially during the night. You'll hear your patients say, I don't know what happened. I didn't eat all night and my blood sugars were so high in the morning. That's because your liver is pumping out too much sugar during the night. So I like blaming stuff on organs. You also have increased lipolysis. What does this mean? Well, it means your fat cells resist insulin. So your fat cells are pumping out, I would say it differently, that your fat cells are not storing triglycerides. Your fat cells are not storing free fatty acids. They're just floating around in your bloodstream. And free fatty acids cause a lot of inflammation of your blood vessels, a lot of inflammation. They're not good. Another thing that happens with type 2 diabetes is there's more glucagon secretion. So remember your pancreas, it makes insulin and glucagon. Well, with type 2 diabetes, your pancreas makes less insulin and more glucagon. Glucagon raises blood sugar levels. Then, as I mentioned, your muscles are responsible for 85% of the uptake of glucose after a meal. But with type 2 diabetes, the muscle cells become very insulin resistant, so the glucose stays in the blood. Then you don't make enough gut hormones. So gut hormones released from the L cells help lower your blood sugars. With type 2 diabetes, you make about 50% less gut hormone. Then you don't feel full. So you make less gut hormone, you don't feel full, you keep eating, and on top of it, to make matters worse, you reabsorb too much glucose. Normally, without diabetes, the glucose threshold is 180. What does that mean? It means when your blood sugar is higher than 180, you release extra sugar through your urine. But with diabetes, that glucose threshold is raised to 210. So you don't release glucose till your blood sugars are more than 210. And there's a new class of medications you might have heard of called the SGLT2 inhibitors that actually tell the kidneys, release the sugar. It's okay. You don't need to hold on to it. And so for each of these defects, we're trying to figure out ways to fix it. And we'll talk more about that in the medication section. But you can see, with all of these things broken with type 2 diabetes, now we understand why it's so hard to get glucose control. It is not the patient's fault when the blood sugars are too high. Certainly, you know, the more they are active and the healthier they eat, the better their blood sugar levels are going to be. But sometimes, despite our patient's best efforts, because of all these things that are malfunctioning, their blood sugars are still high. So truly, hyperglycemia is a result of this whole system not working in concert anymore, and that the hormones that raise blood sugars are more in control because there's not enough hormones to help balance that out to lower the blood sugars. And so our patients are going to ask us a lot of questions like, you know, what is diabetes, and do I have to take medications and how come I got it and do I have to check my blood sugars? So we really want to take time to explain to them what is diabetes. And many times I'll just start off and say, you know what, diabetes is a problem because there's too much sugar in your blood, because your pancreas isn't working right. That's my basic explanation. And then if they have more questions, I'll go over it more. And they ask me, will this go away? I'm like, it's not going to go away, but you can manage it through your actions, through eating healthfully and getting active and taking medications and seeing the dietitian and meeting with the diabetes team and working with your provider. You can get your diabetes under control. So you want to give them a message of hope early on that even though this doesn't go away, you can manage it. And actually, a lot of people end up getting healthier because of diabetes. There's this one gal, Sherry Shepherd. She's from The View, and she was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and she said, getting diabetes saved my life, because she was just on this pathway of not taking care of herself, and getting diabetes slowed her down and really helped her to focus on her health, which was a gift for her. And so I do want to say, sometimes I'll have people tell me, well, my patient's non-compliant, they're not checking their blood sugars. I just had a gal come in and see me yesterday, and she said, Beverly, I don't take my diabetes medications. And I said, well, tell me why not. She goes, I don't like taking them. And then I go, well, tell me why you don't like taking them. And she's like, well, I don't really know if they work or not, and I don't want them to damage my liver. So you could call her non-compliant, but I did not see her as non-compliant. I saw her as worried that these medications would damage her liver, and I also heard her say, I don't know if these are actually going to work. And her A1C, I want to tell you, was 11.8. What does that mean? Well, she was running, you know, in the 300s all the time. And so we just had a heart-to-heart. And I said, you know what? And she was worried metformin would harm her liver. And I said, metformin is cleared by the liver. It's, you know, broken down by the liver. It won't harm your liver. And these medications were really going to help you. And I said, would you be willing to try for a week to check your blood sugars and see how these medications affect your blood sugars? And she said, yes, I would. And that's actually called paired glucose testing, when I have this comment down here. And so if patients say, I don't want to do diabetes, my blood sugars never change, I hear them say that, and I go, that is frustrating. Let's just try something different and see when you check your blood sugars if they come down. If they don't come down, we need to do something differently. We need to make a change in the plan. And so this is very important to help people make this relationship. Another thing we could do is ask patients, tell me the one thing that's driving you crazy about your diabetes. And that, if we have very limited time, can help us focus in on what they want to hear. And look what I have here. This is actually from Bill Polansky. He's a very famous diabetes educator and researcher on this topic, but discuss medication beliefs. If people don't believe their medications are going to work, they're not going to take them. So I'll let you know what happens with her. She's going to get back to me next week, and let's see if her blood sugars improve. So just to compare type 1, type 2, and LADA, who's most likely to be obese are type 2s. Who's most likely to need insulin are type 1s, and LADAs need it. You know, really, we should start it early on to help protect whatever remaining beta cells they have. Who responds to oral agents? Well, our type 1s will not, but our type 2s do. LADAs, usually we can do insulin and an oral agent together to help get their blood sugars down. Who's likely to burn fat for fuel and get ketosis? It's our type 1s. Very rarely are type 2s or LADAs. Who has autoantibodies? Well, our type 1s and our LADAs do. They have autoimmune disease. Type 2s do not. Typical age of onset for type 1 is teenagers. For type 2 adults, the average age currently is 45. And LADA, it really varies, but mostly in the adult phase, around the 30s to 50s would be pretty common. But you know what? LADAs, like I said, they can go all the way until the end of life. I've seen it happen. So just look for it at any time. Type 1 can happen at any time. Type 2 also. But I'm just telling you the most concentrated time of diagnosis here. Insulin resistance, mostly are type 2s. The other thing about diabetes is it doesn't just cause high blood sugars. Diabetes is also associated with fatty liver disease, sleep apnea, cancer. We know that diabetes, insulin resistance, visceral adiposity is more associated with cancers of the pancreas, liver, and breast, Alzheimer's. It's often called type 3 diabetes because in the brain, insulin is a neurotransmitter. When you have diabetes, you make less insulin, and so you don't have a good neurotransmission in the brain, and that can lead to dementia also. So I have a lot of patients I'm working with, when their blood sugars are high, their dementia really worsens. So getting blood sugars down improves clarity of thinking and protects those neurons. And depression is another complication often associated with diabetes. So diabetes isn't just hyperglycemia. It also has to do with these other conditions, plus, of course, cardiovascular disease, which we'll be discussing more. In conclusion, I just want to talk very briefly about other types of diabetes, gestational and other specific types. And I have a whole webcast, level 2, about women and diabetes. I would encourage you to listen to, because in this webcast, I just briefly will talk about gestational diabetes, but it does affect 7% of all of our pregnancies, and we've seen the prevalence of gestational diabetes really increasing during the past 20 years, and as with regular diabetes, it affects certain ethnic groups more readily. The thing about gestational diabetes is that within 5 years of diagnosis of GDM, the woman has a 50% chance of developing diabetes in the next 5 years. So actually, gestational diabetes rates are really a predictor of diabetes in the future in our communities, because women who have gestational diabetes are more likely to get diabetes after pregnancy, and their children are more likely to get diabetes. And so the question is, can we help prevent gestational diabetes, or just do some women get it? Well, the answer is pretty straightforward in one way, and that is if a woman can get her body weight down before and during pregnancy, it does decrease her risk of gestational diabetes. So moving into pregnancy with a healthy weight and not gaining too much weight during pregnancy does decrease a woman's chances of expressing gestational diabetes. We want to tell our women this, especially women who have a family history of diabetes. They're at greater risk. It is true, I will say, that some women, despite their best efforts of exercising and losing weight and not gaining too much weight before and during pregnancy, they still get GDM. So some women still may get it because their genetics are so strong, but we know about 60% of women have the potential to prevent gestational diabetes by getting more active and keeping their weight down before and during pregnancy. So really, really important message to share with our women. Because women with gestational diabetes have more complications during their pregnancy and they have more fetal complications. And the environment in the uterus is very important for that child, because they're thinking now that that intrauterine environment really sets that the health of the child up for the rest of their life. So the healthier that intrauterine environment, the better. So now what we're saying is screen for undiagnosed type 2 at the first prenatal visit. So now any person who gets pregnant, any woman who gets pregnant, when they're establishes being pregnant, check their blood sugars right away. And if they're normal, we wait till 24 to 28 weeks to recheck to see if they have gestational diabetes. But if they're found to have diabetes at their initial prenatal visit, we call that diabetes in pregnancy. That woman now has diabetes, probably type 2 or maybe type 1, but most likely type 2 diabetes that we've just discovered with pregnancy. So what we call her is a person with diabetes in pregnancy. But if we find out that when we come to their first prenatal visit, their blood sugar is normal, but when we check at 24 to 28 weeks and they have higher than normal blood sugar levels, that's gestational diabetes. After a woman has gestational diabetes, she has a 50% risk of getting diabetes in 5 years. So we definitely want to screen her within 6 to 12 weeks postpartum and at regular intervals. We're also going to encourage women to breastfeed, get healthy, get your weight down, keep connected with your healthcare team, and make sure they follow up and monitor your blood sugar, blood pressure, and cholesterol. And before you get pregnant again, just be prepared for it and be in the best shape possible. The American Diabetes Association does say that women who had gestational diabetes, who now have pre-diabetes, start them on metformin therapy because we know they're at such high risk for getting diabetes in the future. Lastly, we're going to talk about other specific types of diabetes. So we've talked about type 1 and type 2 and LADA and gestational, but people do become hyperglycemic from certain other factors. And the number one factor I see are medications. So steroids, protease inhibitors, Prograf, and also would add to this list the atypical antipsychotics like Zyprexa. They can also make blood sugars go higher than normal. And it can be temporary, but sometimes when we have a patient who goes on steroids, let me just say it this way. Let's put a patient in the hospital. So one patient goes on steroids and his blood sugars are normal, but the patient in the next bed, he goes on steroids and his blood sugars run high. Maybe he's pre-diabetes levels or diabetes levels. So that tells us that that patient has a risk for getting diabetes, and the steroids just unmask that risk. The steroids put stress on the pancreas so it can't keep up with the demand because steroids cause insulin resistance. So I consider hospitalization, steroids, medications, Zyprexa, tube feedings, all of these to be a pancreatic stress test. How well is the pancreas working? And if the pancreas is already defective in a way it doesn't have enough beta cells, then we know that these medications will cause hyperglycemia. If the patient has enough beta cells, they can go on these medications many times and their blood sugars are fine. So I consider these medications a stress test to see how well the pancreas can work. But the thing here is, regardless of cause, we need to treat hyperglycemia, whether it's medications or TPN or infection. We've got to get those blood sugars down to help the patient feel their best every day and, of course, to prevent any complications from happening. So we're concluding this particular webcast, and what are some key points that I want to share with you? Well, be a diabetes detective. We want to find people with diabetes. We know that it takes on average 6.5 years to find people with type 2. We also want to find people with pre-diabetes or people with LADA, GDM, and if patients are having hyperglycemia from other causes, we also want to be aware of that and make sure they get appropriate treatment. And I do want to say, at the center of the pathophysiology and the 8 things that are broken with diabetes is someone living with it every day. So we want to be conscious of that and say, it's not easy living with diabetes every day. It is a lot of work. We want to help them focus on their success and coach and support them toward even more success, because diabetes lasts a lifetime. It's not easy to do it every day. And sometimes our patients might take a diabetes vacation. They might just need a break from it. That's okay. When we meet with them, we're going to gently coach them back. And the other thing I think a lot about with diabetes is that people with diabetes often feel judged by others, and we need to meet them out beyond wrongdoing and right doing in a field and say, you know, we're not here to judge you. We're not here to criticize you. We're just here to support and coach you and get to the best place you can with your diabetes. We can't make anyone change their behavior, but we can sure help light that spark of motivation and so that they can make those changes in their life that will improve their health. I want to thank you so much for joining us and for being patient during our technical issues. And I will be so looking forward to meeting with you next week and going over some more really exciting diabetes information. If you have any questions or comments, we're here. We want to provide the best service for you. And I'm going to stop this recording, but I'm going to stick around for any questions that you all might have. So thank you for joining us, and I really appreciate it. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.